This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stock market? Who cares? Debt and deficit? The big news today, we can use electronics on airplanes, you guys. We'll do some other stories, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Halloween, Thursday, the 31st of October. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. President Obama gave a speech today. Nothing I know especially remarkable about that, or even newsworthy in most cases, because presidents talk all the time giving speeches. This one, though, was at an event called the Select USA Investment Summit. It could easily have been called the Please Won't You Select the USA for Investment Summit, because what the White House is trying to do is convince international investors that despite our well-documented problems, the United States is still an attractive place to do business. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
The Select USA Investment Summit is like a big party for doing business in the USA. Organizer Vinay Tumalapalli says his job is to connect international investors with opportunities and incentives from cities and states throughout the country.
To increase investment, to increase business activity, to ultimately to create more high-paying jobs.
The sold-out event also featured the cheerleader-in-chief.
I want companies around the world to know that I believe there is no better place in the world to do business than the United States of America.
But behind the PR is a serious problem.
The United States' share of foreign direct investment around the world has fallen a lot in the past 10 years.
Matt Slaughter teaches at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. He says in 2000, the U.S. share of global foreign direct investment was around 37%.
And by 2012, that share had fallen to just 17%.
That's bad because foreign direct investment creates higher paying jobs that the U.S. desperately needs. So what's the holdup? Kent Smetters is a professor at the Wharton School.
Tax rates have gone up. The corporate income tax rate in the United States is the second highest in the industrial world.
Other economists point to infrastructure problems and lack of comprehensive immigration reform. So while this event may get foreign investors to come along for a date, they may need more to tie the knot and move in. I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
From the FAA today, the Federal Aviation Administration, this announcement, if I might paraphrase. Yeah, okay. You guys were right. Readers and tablets aren't going to bring down airplanes. The FAA has signed off on plans to let us use electronics during takeoff and landing, which means a whole lot more time to do work or to play words with friends. I don't know. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
It can be hard to feel anything than soul-crushing frustration when you're flying. The baggage fees, the security line, the cramped seats. Well, today, score one for us human sardines. The FAA will allow electronic devices throughout the flight. Michael Huerta is the Federal Aviation Administrator. He knows it's a big deal.
My 17-year-old son thinks this is the coolest thing around.
You'll be able to keep on reading or listening to music, but you still got to turn off the cell phone part of your phone. Joseph Schwederman is a transportation expert at DePaul University.
This is a game changer.
He added up all the digital time lost because of powering down during takeoff and landing. And you want to guess? More than 100 million hours of disrupted technological activity this year.
And now they'll be able to sort of plan to do work or to plan to stay connected. People find that therapeutic to use their devices. So airlines certainly will welcome this.
It's also a win for airplane wireless providers. Shares of the in-flight Wi-Fi company Gogo rose more than 4% today. And the rules mean flight attendants will get to stop nagging people to turn off their Kindles. Vita Shook is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants.
Well, we want to make sure that there is consistency across the board in how this new rule is implemented.
She hopes it's not going to be used as a marketing tool by airlines to get an advantage over each other, because flight attendants have already had to do their fair share of arguing over the rules. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down, then up, then down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, went up to Capitol Hill yesterday, as you probably heard by now. She spent three some odd hours answering questions about the cascading failures of healthcare.gov and the Affordable Care Act. Pretty early on in the day, she said this.
I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems.
Nancy Kane is a professor of the history of business at the Harvard Business School. We have her on from time to time. Nancy, it's great to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
I am curious, and the reason we have you on the phone is to get a little insight and perspective as to why, honestly, nobody's getting fired over this. This is a massive failure. Everybody's saying, hold me accountable, and yet nobody's being held accountable, specifically Secretary Sebelius.
I'm not sure no one will get fired. Okay. I think there'll be a sacrificial lamb. That doesn't negate the fact that we don't have any accountability. And I think that's a function, if I step back and, you know, I can put my historian's cap on, of a kind of, you know, long, slow burn into something like an accountability crisis where we don't hold the banking heads responsible for the financial crisis. We don't hold our, you know, elected officials responsible for inefficiencies, incompetency, and, you know, very, very significant costs because they can't work and play nicely in the congressional sandbox. And I think we've come to, in some sense, without thinking about it, almost accept this as a given. And from the large picture perspective, that is not a good thing.
How did we get here then? What has happened?
I'm not sure from whence this slow settling of not demanding accountability came from. You know, there have been in the last 20 years some very prominent examples of leaders who have stepped up to the plate and said, I own this. I'm going to make it better. I take full responsibility. Think of James Burke and the Tylenol crisis. Mm-hmm. You think of Dave Neeleman, the CEO of JetBlue in 2000, saying, you know, we didn't create the blizzard, but my goodness, we're responsible for the experience, passengers had on those planes sitting there on the runway. It won't happen again.
But Nancy, here's the thing. Sebelius yesterday said, hold me accountable. The president yesterday said, I am responsible. And yet those words are meaningless unless there's a consequence.
Well, I agree. And so, you know, so such pretty words, but what do they mean? So it's part of a general soup that we're swimming in which we don't, as citizens, consumers, voters, members of communities, demand something better for our very prominent officials and leaders. And the only thing that I can really, in a sense, answer for, in, again, a historical sense, is that at some level, elite behavior has become elite behavior of the elites that operate in the ether of celebrity and power is extremely disconnected to individual everyday interactions and duties and responsibilities that define most of our lives, at least at the community and family level.
Let me get a reality check here on my attitude on this. Am I being puritanical when I raise these questions?
The very fact that you're asking that question says that, no, you're not being puritanical, that we're somehow living in a world in which we've forgotten that there are things that are wrong and things that are right and mistakes are made and it is right action and socially beneficial for those responsible to answer for it and make it better.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
My pleasure. I heave a sigh at this, Kai, but always great to talk to you.
There are parts of the modern economy, the high-tech economy to be precise, that seem to be a bit conflicted. In Silicon Valley, where the overriding profit motive is to move huge parts of our lives online, the actual business culture is all about meeting face-to-face, as Marketplace's Quina Kim reports.
In Silicon Valley, it feels like everybody's always meeting. They're meeting investors for coffee or having a walking meeting. Steve Jobs was famous for those. And every day there are talks, conferences, or private parties where techies go to meet.
Hi, yes, can I help you?
Yeah, I'm here for the Google Ventures dinner.
Absolutely, right this way there.
Google Ventures is Google's venture capital fund. They invest in startups. And investors are serious meeters.
There you go. Enjoy your evening.
Thank you so much. The waitress takes me to a private dining room upstairs, and the cocktails are flowing. It's a star-studded crowd in a geeky kind of way. Kevin Rose from Dig is there. So is Rich Miner. He's a co-creator of Android. Both of them work for Google Ventures. Miner tells me he's been on the meeting merry-go-round since 5 a.m.
Today, I think I've had about 10 meetings. I took an Uber to San Francisco, had a breakfast meeting with two of the co-founders of one of my portfolio companies.
After breakfast, Miner was off to a board meeting for another company he's funding. Then he met up with an ex-Googler who had an interesting idea for a startup. Steve Szyzinski teaches entrepreneurship at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. He says all this running around for FaceTime is part of the tech culture.
When you do startups, you're not investing in a company that doesn't exist. You're investing in people who are going to make this company happen.
Szyzinski's also the general manager of SRI, which created Apple's Siri and the computer mouse. And part of his job is to help techie startup companies.
This is probably my 20th meeting of the day. I enjoy meetings. I was just over at Stanford showing somebody from Malaysia. He's part of the prime minister's office. I was showing him around.
Then he was off to Cafe Baroni for a quick coffee with a Romanian entrepreneur. Szyzinski says it's important to see them in action.
How does a person react to pressure? It's also fun to see how these founders get along. Do they compliment each other? Do they correct each other? If they do correct each other, how do they correct each other? I've actually seen a couple of people get into pretty strong arguments, and those are not companies I like to invest in.
Szyzinski says those moments, they don't happen in a conference room where the meetings are sort of scripted.
Oh, hey, how are you doing?
I'm Queen. I'm Maha. Nice to meet you.
Maha Ibrahim is a partner at Canaan Partners, a venture capital firm in Menlo Park.
I probably put a good 60, 70,000 miles on my car every year.
Ibrahim says she clocks most of those miles driving the 60 miles back and forth to San Francisco, where there's a thriving startup scene.
Silicon Valley is filled with what we call FOMO, the fear of missing out. So everyone is constantly meeting in the event that that one incremental meeting gets you to that deal that you otherwise would have missed.
Which is the next big thing?
Which is the next big Google. That's right.
Back at the Google Ventures dinner, it's about 11 o'clock. Rich Miner, the venture capitalist and a co-creator of Android, he's on his phone.
I'm sending a text message to another one of our CEOs to see if he wants to grab a nightcap.
And why not? There's still another hour left in the day. Plenty of time for another meeting. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Even though people love what we do, there's a point where they say, well, yeah, you know, business cards for $1,000 might be a little much.
Hence the latest installment of our series, Disappearing Jobs. But first, let's do the numbers. Halloween didn't haunt Wall Street too bad. Today, the Dow Industrial's off 73 points. That's about 0.5%, 15,545. The NASDAQ edged down 10 points, 0.3%, 39.19. The S&P 500 off 6 points, 0.4%, ended things at 1756. What a great month, though. In October, the Dow gained 2.8%. The NASDAQ rose 3.9%. The S&P 500 did best of all, up 4.5%. Weight Watchers International was, to borrow a phrase, one of the biggest losers. Its shares sank 19% today. That after the weight control firm suspended its dividend because of trouble recruiting new members. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.55%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories?
Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. Automakers are slated to release sales figures for October. Those cars gotta fuel up. Chevron reports quarterly earnings. And on November 1st, 1959, goalie Jacques Plante donned a full face mask during a hockey game. The date is widely regarded as the anniversary of the hockey mask. It's also been worn by slasher Jason Voorhees. Great fashion statement. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a data set that the Labor Department publishes every month that tells us how many people are quitting their jobs. A lot of people are quitting their jobs, it turns out. In August, which is the latest data that we have, 2,364,000 workers told their bosses to take this job, and you know what? That's 11% higher than it was last year. Sally Herships tells us why.
Are you a quitter? It may sound like an insult, but when it comes to the economy, leaving your job can be a good thing.
People quit jobs when they have an opportunity to go someplace else. Most everybody who quits voluntarily steps immediately into another job.
Peter Capelli teaches management at Wharton. He says the increase in quitters is about confidence in the economy. During the recession, employers pushed workers hard. Some surveys found 3/4 of workers at the time said they were going to look for a new job as soon as they could. For some, that meant waiting for affordable health care.
That's one of the biggest nuts to carry.
Andrea Grayson is a marketing consultant who recently quit her job to work on her own. She lives in Vermont and says her state's plan to offer health care based on income helped her reach a decision.
That definitely did add a level of confidence to my ability to be able to sustain my expenses when I'm out on my own.
The economy needs more quitters like Grayson. Every time someone quits, it's an opening for someone else. That's according to Steve Kyle. He teaches applied economics at Cornell.
The quit rate fell off a cliff and has since been slowly trudging back into territory which we would more normally associate with a normal economy. But it's not there yet.
Kyle says to get back to normal, America needs 2% of its workforce to quit. But don't worry, there's another way openings can be created. Employers can lay off their workers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You know how when you go back to a place you haven't visited in 10 or 20 years, it takes you a while to calibrate yourself and get adjusted to the changes? When that place is China, take it from me, it's a whole different thing. The scale and the speed of the change there is overwhelming, due mostly to the way that the Chinese economy has changed and grown the past 2 decades. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz went out to Sichuan Province last week, to the town where he lived and worked 17 years ago. He sent us back this reporter's notebook.
Life as a Peace Corps volunteer in Zigong was never very peaceful. In 1996, when I came here to teach English at the local teachers' college, I lived next door to the music department. 17 years later, the music still plays, the sound of students working hard, making lots of mistakes, and learning from them. Back then, China's economy was doing the same thing, breaking loose from the tight control of the state to join the global economy.
Here's some of the kids who play soccer around here.
Shortly after I arrived, I made a home video to send back to my family. One of the kids, 12-year-old Zeng Yang, knocked on my door after I'd been there a week. He told me I was the first foreigner he had ever seen. He asked if I could teach him English. His dad was a teacher in the art department. They lived a few floors above me in a drab concrete apartment block. His family, like most families in Zigong, made less than $100 a month. 17 years later, Zeng picks me up in the provincial capital of Chengdu in his brand new VW Bug. Each day, this city limits traffic to certain numbered license plates to curb air pollution. To get around that, Zeng simply bought 5 cars, one for every day of the week. He's on the move. At 29 years old, he's now one of China's top young artists.
When I was young, I played with toy cars, but I never imagined I'd be able to buy one.
Zhang sells his paintings for $20,000 each, and he's got brokers in New York and Paris. His oil paintings are colorful, abstract depictions of migrant workers in the big city. They're filled with social commentary about a traditional rural society transforming into an urban one.
Growing up in Zigong inspired my art. People there aspire to be urban and modern, but Zigong can't escape its rural setting.
On the street in Zigong, I see what he means. A man selling candy advertises by clicking his knife with a curved piece of iron. He's got two baskets tied to a bamboo pole balanced on his shoulder, like merchants here have done for centuries. He's walking through the old town. Across the river, there's a McDonald's, a Walmart, and dozens of luxury condo buildings. Back in the 90s, this was all terraced hills of rice paddies. My old school has now moved here, too.
How are you? Good to see you.
Hi, thank you.
It's so good to see you.
Wow. Yes, so yeah.
I stopped by to see my friends in the English department. Liao Qinfang used to live upstairs from me.
Yeah. How is your family?
It's good.
Good.
My son has just left for Estonia.
Estonia?
Yeah, Estonia to study piano.
Another teacher, Wang Chunyang, just bought an SUV to take road trips to photograph China's national parks.
Back in 1996, where was the farthest you had traveled back then?
The furthest, furthest city I traveled to was Chongqing.
Back then, the big city, 100 miles away, was the edge of the world. Now the rest of the world has come to Zigong. Back in the studio of my young artist friend, Zeng Yang, we talk about these changes. He says now he barely recognizes his hometown.
In China, we have a saying, a leaf returns to its roots when it falls. If an entire country cuts off its leaves, its branches, and its roots, then its people become lost.
That could be so, but my friends in Zigong, like those music students I listened to every night in my apartment so long ago, are finding their way. They've all tapped into the global economy to pursue their dreams. In Zigong, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got an occasional series we're doing called Disappearing Jobs. People whose jobs are changing or going away entirely because the economy we all live in is changing too. Today we're going back in time a little ways to the days before ebooks and laser printers and everybody reading everything on tablets anyway. We're going to a company called Aardvark Letterpress where they still do things the old-fashioned way.
My name is Carrie Ocon. We're at Aardvark Letterpress in the heart of Los Angeles. We do printing, letterpress printing, which is a specialty, sort of a stamp of letterpress, is that it makes an impression. Literally speaking, it's relief printing. So, yeah, so often somebody comes in and they're just, they hold something. When you give someone a business card that's been letterpressed, they just, they don't want to put it down.
How come this is the one that's left? There used to be letterpress companies all over the city. How come you guys are still here?
There were a lot of them, and I don't know why we're here. You know, we're survivors. There was a time when we were, barely able to pay the rent. Now we can pay the rent and maybe a couple of utility bills, and we just, I think, persevered, and kind of everyone else died off, and now there aren't a lot of other places to go. It's us.
How's business?
Business is good. There's challenges with what we do because everything is so labor-intensive, time-intensive, and we can't really charge what we should be charging to recover all of our time and efforts because even though people love what we do, there's a point where they say, well, yeah, business cards for $1,000 might be a little much, even though it's amazing.
Do you see a way that you can keep going?
I think we can. We're not doing mainly business stuff. We're doing, invitations, and we're working with a lot of artists, a lot of people in the entertainment world, creative people. We're trying to incorporate the old technologies. This is 600-year-old stuff that Gutenberg developed, but integrate it with the digital world and younger artists, and it's like this sort of marriage of old and new together, which I think there's such a big interest nowadays. This is something you'll like.
I like it all, man.
Yeah, well, this is always kind of a cheap trick, except it's not so cheap. This one you have to do manually.
Wow.
You take each letter out by one at a time. So I'm going to set your name R-Y-S-S, right?
Yeah.
D-A-L. L. So each of these letters is a mold.
Oh, and it goes into a thing.
It goes into a thing. That's the technical name for it. And
look at that.
See? And there's the mold.
Wow.
So what this machine does...
This is like hot lead stuff, right?
It is hot lead.
Get out of here.
So I lock this in here, hit this button, and it's going to... Excuse me. It's going to shoot the lead into the stick, into the mold. That's done. And out will come if it works.
That's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
It's also really hot.
It's a little hot, not too hot.
Well, I'm an office guy.
Yeah, man. That's true. And that's ready to print. You know, we give that to the press, and then he locks it up, and boom, boom, boom.
We took some video while we were out at Aardvark. Lots of cool old machines there. We've got it online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, just because Wall Street is not a scary enough place, we did some asking around to see what would scare the pants off of folks at a Wall Street Halloween party.
Well, boy, if I was going to a Halloween party with other bankers, I would dress as Eric Holder. That is so scary. I don't think the guys from J.P. Morgan could even stay in the same room.
Come in a suit and tie and say, I'm a stockbroker. Have to count your fingers after you shake hands with your brokers.
I think the thing that has and should have Wall Street scared is the specter of deflation. And maybe I would dress up as like one of those death characters or something, you know, with the black robes and stuff.
I guess one thing I would dress up as is the Fed's balance sheet, because like the blob, it just keeps growing and growing.
Maybe I'll dress up like the housing bubble. I'll be dressed up like the house, and I'll blow bubbles everywhere we go.
That was In Order. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. David Menlo from IPOfinancial.com. Chief economist Steve Blitz from ITG. Eric Parnell is an analyst at Gehring Wealth Management. And finally, James Angel. He's a finance professor at Georgetown. Me? I don't dress up. Nuh-uh. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.